forgot to, wait a minute, I forgot to the microphone.
Oh, Spencer, I do have an announcement.
So I presume that you signed in. And if you are not registered, that you are registered. Because if you didn't, these chairs are magic chairs, and there's a trapdoor underneath each one of them. So you have to be sure you're signed in. If you didn't sign in, the chairs will know. So Iris, are you registered? I think you need to go see that woman right there. Okay.
There's no escaping.
Okay. Iris, Lisa, that's Iris Clark. The things. Okay. Let's get going. I had this whole sob story about why you have to sign in, so I guess I'll give it to you really briefly, which is City College is in the red by major millions of dollars. So they're looking for every cent they can find, and you're making them money by sitting here, but not if you don't sign in. A bunch of announcements really quickly. First, on Friday, October 4th, Dr. Gay Hendricks is going to be talking at the Marjorie Luke Theater. There are a few, the Consciousness Network is putting that on. There are a few posters on the table. The Mind, Body, and Soul series continues next Tuesday at the Marjorie Luke Theater, and it's going to be Dave Mogul, his second of three talks. You've never seen Dave Mogul, he's really... There are no better presenters than Dave Mogul. When I saw that, when Dave Mogul came to this class, okay, remember I invited him to this class like before he became Dave Mogul? and the minute he started to lead that meditation, it took me about 2 minutes. You know, usually when people start to lead a meditation, I'm kind of listening to how they do it kind of like hearing that they kind of didn't quite get that word right. You know how it is when you know something and you're kind of comparing other people. And after about 2 minutes of Dave Mogul leading that meditation, I just relaxed. And I realized that I was in the hands of a master. Every word was perfect. Every timing was perfect. And that lecture that we had in this class, how many people were at that lecture?
When was that?
That was like 2 years ago. That was about the most extraordinary presentation. I couldn't believe it. I walked out of there thinking, I have a long way to go. This guy is really something. M-O-C-H-E-L.
There's a website called appliedattention.com. Yeah. It's filled with resources on meditation and probably 10 different meditations that it can lead you through.
They're just perfect. They're perfect. So appliedattention.com. And if you've not seen Dave Mogul, go for $22 to the Marjorie Luke Theater next Tuesday night and listen to him. Art Fair. You don't get away for nothing here. There's a tariff to be. Oh, never mind. There's a price you have to pay for. Don't forget to sign in, everybody. So there's a price to be paid for this class, which is on the last day of class, November 8th. We'll probably let you in if you don't bring a piece of artwork that you've done, but we will frown at you. The art fair is November 8th, and that, please bring some creative project that you've done or something that you would like to share. It's wonderful to have all this stuff displayed around the room and kind of circulate around and look at that. We'll also have a class that day, but part of it will be looking at one another's artwork. So please bring your art in. That's the last class on November 8th.
I'm about the super lion.
I'm getting there. Mind and Supermind is on November 4th. It's in this room, so we'll only be limited to 150 people. It's Drs. Radley Weininger and Michael Kearney. And many of you know about them because they've been so central in the community. That'll be a wonderful evening, I'm sure. They're going to lead us through a bunch of stuff as well as talk. So it's Mind Supermind on November 4th. Get tickets in advance because it will sell out. Chris, are you here?
Yeah.
Will you do that?
I guess.
Okay, because it's really interesting.
Yeah. Chris, take this.
Yeah. Oh, like here.
Okay, I received an email from Mary Beth Goodman that she thought we might all be interested in this. It's a free online summit from October 12th to October 20th titled Collective Trauma Online Summit. And it has 25 speakers. The experts in all the fields of trauma, including Dan Siegel and Kim Wilber.
Yeah.
So if you go online and Google Collective Trauma Online Summit, it will show up. And it's free, and the DVDs are available afterwards if people want to listen to it at other times.
So if you would like more information, see Chris, or go to Collective Trauma
Online Summit.
Collective Trauma Online Summit. Okay, so the reason that we're emphasizing this is because pretty much everybody who's anybody in trauma is going to be talking. For example, Bessel van der Kolk and Peter Levine are going to be speaking. So they're like the people that wrote the books on trauma. Collective trauma is different than individual trauma, so I'm kind of interested in that focus. But apparently, they think that what we're going through right now isn't exactly healthy. Wonder why. Okay, so, let's see, are there announcements? Yes.
Speaking of collective trauma, the big collective trauma is the climate crisis. So immediately after this class, go down to De La Guerra Plaza. This is the climate strike. This is the thing connected with what Greta Thunberg is doing. So this is a big event, De La Guerra Plaza. It'll be a little march, and then there's going to be talks there.
Today?
Today, immediately after this talk.
I guess I'll talk a tiny bit about that. Which is, this is a whole huge long talk, but how many people saw at least part of Greta Thunberg's talk to the people of the United Nations? That was something. But she's 16 and she got the bloody bungee or equivocate. And it was remarkable what she said. You know, like, if you don't do something about this, we will never forgive you. And that's galvanizing a lot of people, especially a lot of young people. And as I said in my positive psychology class last night, I'm guardedly optimistic, because what I'm hearing is what I've been waiting to hear since the 1960s, which is young people saying, we really got to do something about this, and we're going to. So it's for many of us, it's the next rebirth of consciousness that's happening in young people. And what makes it so promising is the very same thing that you're going to see today makes it so bad, which is what's in everybody's pocket. They're connected. And they're connected more to one another than they are to their elders. Their horizontal connection is stronger than their vertical connection. So they're identified with the people that they Instagram and that they play video games with around the world. And that's their cohort, and it's a world cohort, and it's all connected. And so it's very powerful, especially as it reaches voting age. And so the kids in my class last night, they were all, this is what we're going to do. So hopefully, if we can last long enough for the kids that are now teenagers and preteens to get to the age where they can put their ballot in, we're going to see some major change. It's just a question of time, and it's a race. Anyhow, I thought I'd tell you that. but that's not what we came here to do. Okay, so we're going to do two things today, certainly, or three things today, certainly, and maybe a fourth at the very end if I have time, so if I'm kind of talking fast. First is we're going to do our meditation. Then I'm going to follow up last week, because last week was a lot of material that went by fast, and a little bit of that I need to underline. And then after that, I'm going to show you the most depressing thing that I'm glad it's overcast today. The most depressing thing that I'm going to show you all semester by far, but probably the most important thing. Okay, and that's going to be a video. We'll probably talk about it a little bit. Okay, so about meditation, first of all, in the 10 minutes that we sit, you can do any meditation that you want. Anything that seems to be appropriate for you to do. Trust your own intuition about this. If you're doing mindfulness, last week we talked about thought and how thought tends to be fused with attention. And it takes a while for you to separate thought and attention so that you understand what attention is by itself. And then you realize that you can attend to thoughts rather than thinking about thoughts. And when people are first meditating, their initial revelation, I call it the first portal to enlightenment, is at some point they realize that they are listening to their own thoughts rather than thinking about their own thoughts. And they can distinguish the attention from the thing that is being attended to. They hear their thoughts. Oh, my thoughts are up there. And this pure sentient quality of attention is noticing those thoughts. And so for a while, the preoccupation is with noticing what you're thinking. But I think I can't be sure because I don't know about everybody from inside, but my strong understanding is that for most of us, there's a progression beyond that. Which is, after a while, you're hearing your own thoughts, and first of all, they're quieting down when you sit, because now you're not feeding them with constant, making more of them. So the thoughts tend to quiet down, and also they kind of tend to get less interesting, because you've heard all the nonsense before. You know, it's like, wow, we'll think of that again, And because something else is arising into your awareness that's much more powerful. And that something is your feelings, your emotions. That is, after a while, your emotional process becomes louder than your intellectual process. And that's pretty interesting. And usually when that happens, people think that, if I just feel my emotions fully, they'll dissipate, because I just have to let them out. And then they'll dissipate, and then I'll be fine. I'll be enlightened, or I'll be blissful. But that doesn't happen. What happens is your emotions get stronger. They don't go away. What makes emotions go away is when you understand why you're having the emotion and what the emotion is telling you you need to do in your life in order to make your emotion different. Remember, emotions are just, I've defined that in this class a bunch of times, emotions are just your whole organism reacting to your life situation and what you think. But if you're sad when you meditate and the emotion is sadness that comes up, it's not going to go away no matter what kind of jujitsu you do or magic you think you're doing. That emotion is saying, I'm missing something. Something is not there that should be there. And until you understand why that emotion is coming up and what it is that you're missing, you can't go get it. And the emotion will keep coming up and up and up and up because it's your organism telling you, I need something I'm not getting, right? If you're angry every time or resentful every time you sit, it means that there's some element of your life that is threatening to you, that is inimical to your life. And if you don't do something about it, every time you sit, that emotion will come up. So it's like a dipstick into how well you're living, okay? And so your emotions, they guide you to how to improve your life. So what does it feel like to be sitting and feel emotion? Well, if your thoughts are so loud that you're either completely absorbed in them, you don't even feel you're breathing, or you're at least feeling you're breathing and noticing how loud your thoughts are, then what I suggest is you shift attention. If we were 5 years old and the teacher said, children, where are your feelings? Point to your feelings, children. Not here. Where do you point?
Probably your gut.
Some people gut more, some people heart, but here, okay? But how often when you're sitting do you pay any attention to that besides the breathing? So the question is, when you look here, what do you find? And startlingly, when I ask people to do that of any age, mostly what they find is nothing. There's nothing there. Does that mean I only have emotions occasionally when they're really strong? No. I think maybe you're so lost in thought that you kind of can't feel what's happening in the whole system. But as you pay more attention, you recover emotional awareness. And that's vital to your vitality. What do emotions feel like when you start to feel them on a continuing basis? Unfortunately, there are no words in the English language. It's ineffable. But what people say is it's kind of like a flavoring on my life that kind of comes out of me, or an emanation, or a coloring on my life. And it's subtle, but it's strong at the same time, and it feels physical and not physical at the same time. It's not like a clenching gut. That's a physical symptom that comes from the whole system. But it's kind of like a vibration or a state of the whole thing. Of which the thought is part. I mean, it's all one thing. But this is the tip of the iceberg. Most of it's going on here. So to recover emotional process when you're meditating, you just kind of hang out here and you feel, what do I feel? It's like thump, 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 and gurgle, gurgle, gurgle. You know, what's happening here? And what tends to happen is this subtle but strong vibration or emanation tends to come into awareness and tends actually to not be inside you. It's in front of you. It's like here that you feel it. Not here. It's like you've taken a step back. And you can clearly feel this vibratory quality right here. And it changes every moment. We don't have one emotion at a time. That's nonsense. That's the brain trying to make sense of something that's way too complicated. You have a blend of preparations for life happening at once, because life is very complicated. So the emotional, what you feel, is like a modern art painting that constantly commutes and the colors constantly change and the saturation constantly changes. So it's fascinating to pay attention to your emotional process. And it gives you a lot of information. So that's enough about emotions. That's all of which is to say that when you sit and you feel your breathing and you let yourself soften and open and you notice what you're thinking, pay some attention to what's going on in the whole being, throughout your body, as well as in your head. Okay? And then we're going to follow it up after we sit with the next thing I'm going to tell you. So let's sit for 10 minutes.
wish there was some way to capture that energy.
Two thoughts that I had that I was sitting and I want to share with you. One is, if you want to hear any of these classes again, or if you miss a class, you go to swt.org/censor, and thanks to Michael and Robert, they're recorded and they're there for your benefit. Also, if you if there's material like Carl Blasius's PowerPoints, so if you want to know what NMN is, you know, where you can find it, you go there and it's posted. I can't tell you how many people have asked me about, where do I get that stuff? Right. And the second thing is, I might have mentioned this last week, so if I did, I'll be very brief. An exercise that I gave to my positive psychology students a week ago was something, and many of you already do this, so if you already do this, do it your way. But what I told my positive psychology students is, instead of doing the usual gratefulness, thankfulness exercise that we do, why don't we try this new one, which is every night before you go to bed, you just say to yourself, what's the thing that I'm most grateful for? And then you just spend a minute to just feel how grateful you are for that person or that thing. That's all. And so this is something I just made up because I didn't like the traditional gratefulness thankfulness exercise, which is listing a bunch of things. And I tried it myself with my students, and we all kind of agreed that it was remarkable. After a while, what happens is it's not something you do just before you go to bed. Something happens during the day, and you say, that's what I'm grateful for. And so it kind of starts to pervade your whole life, this openness to gratefulness and realizing how much you're blessed. You know? So if you wanted to do it, just start in the evening by saying, just one thing or one person, what am I most grateful for right now? And just feel that gratitude. See what happens day after day. Richard.
Something that I've been doing that really has helped me is when I first wake up, I give thanks for another day of life, and then I say things that I'm grateful for from yesterday. I used to say three things, but then I end up listing more, but I, even if it's just one thing. And then I say, what am I looking forward to today that I'm going to be grateful for later? So it kind of primes the engine, bringing up the gratitude from yesterday and what I'm looking forward to being grateful today before I get out of bed. So, and that kind of gets me going for the day.
So, Robert, you want to say thank you? I'm going to comment on it in a minute, Robert.
Oh, I'm sorry. I don't want to destroy this mood, but I read some clinical research that showed it's actually more helpful to do the exact opposite. Think about the worst thing that could happen and be grateful that it didn't happen.
Okay, that's called defensive pessimism. It's called defensive pessimism, and there is some research that shows that by anticipating the worst and realizing it didn't happen, you actually get a boost. But it depends on the personality, I think. From what I've read, some people do better with that. But what's important, especially important about what Richard said, is if you get up and rush out of bed without a kind of setting yourself for the day and your intention and how you adjusting how you are, you miss a really valuable opportunity. And many spiritual traditions have counseled that when you first get up, that's when it's important to do something to set your day up right. There's a whole lecture I do about that, but I'm not going to, because I'm going to give another lecture, but very brief here, okay? Alright, so I want to follow up last week. If you weren't here last week, you missed it, but it'll make sense. I wrote notes just to make sure I didn't miss anything. So again, the difference between emotions and feelings that we established in this class a bunch of times is
emotions are the state of your whole organism at any moment. So you always have emotions. Because your organism is always taking in information about its surroundings and adjusting its functioning to be at its best in the situation. You're always anticipating what would be the next thing that will happen, and you're always preparing yourself for it. So you're constantly, there's a great deal of information coming into your brain, and without your conscious awareness, your organism is adjusting to the situation and what it expects to happen next. Plus which, there's stuff on your mind at various levels. And the stuff on your mind is taken by your whole organism to your reality. And so your organism is not only reacting to the stuff that's happening around you, it's also happening to this, reacting to the stuff happening in your mind. So right now around you, you're sitting in a class and it's kind of interesting, and so probably you're pretty open, but maybe not completely, because maybe there's some trouble at home or something, or somebody's sick, or you know, there's some preoccupation. So at some level, you're kind of worried about that or upset about that. So there's a mix of things happening. Or maybe you've had some good news and that crosses your mind and it kind of opens you up further. So emotions are constantly changing as the situation and what you think about changes. And even subtle changes are interesting, like that just caused a slight amount of startle reaction in you. Orienting reflex. What was that? Because anytime a change happens, the brain registers it specially. Because it could be an opportunity or a threat. So this is happening all the time, but we're not aware of it. Mostly we're thinking about, or we're lost in thought, or we're aware of our thoughts. We generally don't know we have feelings all the time. It's only when they get really big that they take over and go, oh my God, I feel this way. But they're always happening. When you're aware of them, you have conscious feelings. Feelings are consciousness of your emotions, which are continual. And what I've argued in the past year is that being more emotionally aware, that is having more conscious feelings, gives you valuable information about how you're doing and what to do, how to do better. A thing you can ask yourself is, what am I feeling right now? And why? What's the message? Why do I have this feeling? So creatures that have the capacity to check in with themselves, creatures that have the capacity to do this, have a better chance of survival. If you know what's going on inside you, it gives you information that then helps you to live better. So it's a capacity that evolution has developed, especially in human beings. And physiologically, two parts of the brain are especially important in this. One is the insular cortex, or the insula. That has to do with being able to check into your body. And another is the mirror neuron system, which we've only found in some primates and human beings at this point, which is a way to, when you see other people, to know what they're feeling. Because you see their posture and you listen to their intonation of their voice, and you have that same thing happening inside you. So you kind of mirror what you're seeing, and that lets you know, is the other person friendly or unfriendly? Is this going to be an approach or avoid situation necessary here? So the point is that we have some physiological mechanisms that are kind of high-level mechanisms that do this. I think most animals aren't yet evolved enough to kind of check in with their internal workings all the time. They're mostly focused on the outside. This is an evolutionary advantage that I think is, if not entirely human, almost entirely human. Some examples I wrote down. I'm upset, and you look inside yourself and you say, I'm upset and apprehensive. Maybe. So when you feel yourself being upset and apprehensive, then you say to yourself, maybe I better be especially cautious and prepared right now. Because otherwise, why would I be upset? And, you know, if I feel this feeling, it's something, it gives me information that my whole organism understands about the situation I'm in. So if I'm upset and apprehensive, it's either something on my mind or it's something about this situation. Either way, I better pay closer attention here and be a little bit cautious. There's always a lesson for each feeling that you have, or each emotional state that you're in. Or I'm highly stimulated right now. There's a lot of activity in me. Maybe I shouldn't make any hasty major decisions right now. Maybe I should sleep on it first. Because you realize that high arousal is, you don't always make the wisest decision. The point is, when you check in with yourself, it gives you information that then helps you modify your behavior in a healthy way. So, we're getting to the point of last time's lecture, which is about happiness and unhappiness. So when you're unhappy, you ask yourself, so if you know you're unhappy right now, or as you go through your day, you ask yourself, what am I feeling? You check in with yourself, and you say, okay, given that I'm feeling that way, what do I need? Because feelings come from needs. Unmet needs are what cause difficult feelings. Needs that are satisfied are what cause happy feelings. So when you're unhappy, what am I feeling? What do I need? And how can I get it? Those are the three questions you ask yourself that your emotions cue you into. So when you're unhappy, what am I feeling? What do I need? Why is that feeling rising? And how can I get it? So, in therapy or self-therapy, in actual psychotherapy that you do with someone else, or in the self-therapy that we allow us to do fairly continuously, the key is identifying your needs. You need to know what your needs are, and you need to realize that your needs are, they're always legitimate. So what are the needs? Did last time, you remember? So I said there are four basic needs, that one or more of which we are always working on. Our life is always, our organism is always striving to satisfy these needs. First need I put together is health and safety. I broke this down because of the exercise we did last week, but this is need one, health and safety, bodily integrity. Second need, pleasure. By the way, those of you who know the chakra system, the first four chakras. Health and safety, first chakra. Pleasure. In nature, pleasure tells you do more of that, it's life-giving. Displeasure tells you do less of that, it's life-taking. So pleasure is the second need. The third need is these three things put together. A sense of self, of knowing who you are. Identity. Knowing what your needs are, autonomy, having the freedom to satisfy those needs, and ability, having the capacity to satisfy those needs. So this is about knowing yourself, knowing what you need, knowing how to get it. Third chakra. And in this, connection, fourth chakra. Nobody lives alone. We all need connection. It's how we're In Thich Nhat Hanh's words, it's all about interbeing.
And if I need a connection and a relationship, that's what I need.
But it's good that you know that, and so that it motivates you to do stuff like come to class where you have connection, people really care about you here, and other places where you can find connection. But that unmet need, it's needs motivate you, okay? The idea is we're always working on getting these needs met and then keeping them met.
Are you saying that feelings only happen when your needs are not met?
No, absolutely not. Emotions are the state of your organism at any point. Sometimes the state of your organism is everything is fully met and you have really happy, good, contented, fulfilled feelings. And okay, so emotion is the state of your organism at any moment. If you're conscious of it, you say, I have a feeling. And sometimes when all the needs are met, the feelings are great.
Right.
And sometimes when none of the needs are met, the feelings are abysmal. But there's always feeling, and frequently there's a blend, because some of the needs are met and beautifully met, and some of the needs are not met. So there's this you know, how are you feeling? If you're feeling very deep and complexly because there's a lot going on. But again, happiness is when your needs are met. Unhappiness is when your needs are unmet. The kind of unhappiness you're suffering depends on which needs are unmet. The kind of happiness you're experiencing depends on which needs are met. It's as simple as that. And so when you have feelings, they tell you how you're doing in the various areas of your life that are crucial. And they tell you what to do about doing better in those areas. So it's critical to know about how you're feeling and what that means. So when someone is, so when you're unhappy, I gave you the three questions to ask, which is, what am I feeling, what do I need, and how am I going to get it? How about when someone's unhappy with you? First thing you have to do is realize that they're expressing basic needs. So at some level, they are not wrong. Even if what they're saying is inaccurate, what they're saying is, I have a need, and you're part of that process that is not being fulfilled. So you have to listen to the need that they're expressing and understand that that is, they're a human being, they're a creature, they're a live creature, and it's legitimate for them to have that need. And then you think to yourself, how can I change my behavior? They're saying that somehow my behavior is blocking or interfering with their getting their need met. Is it true? And if so, how can I modify my behavior so their need can be met? In any conflict between two people or two countries or two entities of any kind, each entity is coming from needs that should be met. And so each entity has to realize that there's a dual chart. There's two things you have to do. You have to identify your own needs and make sure they get met, and you have to identify the other person's needs and make sure they get met. And if you can do that, the conflict is healed. But it means that you can't stay stuck in me and what I need. You have to go to the other person and understand that they're legitimately saying what they need. And then you talk about strategy. How can we come up with a strategy that makes you happy and me happy? That's the only good outcome, is you have to be heard, and your needs have to be satisfied, and I have to be heard, and my needs have to be satisfied. So if you come that way, there's no longer conflict. There's just a mutual enterprise. If countries are debating with one another, they should sit down and say, look, how can we get create a win-win here? And couples should say that too. Michael.
It's really hard, if not impossible, to give empathy or be present for someone else when we ourselves are needing it. So first, I guess, before we can uplift someone else, we have to be in a state where we're at least getting a certain, base level of needs met. If we need empathy so much, we can't give it until we get it.
Maybe, I don't know, I have to think about that. I think sometimes by getting out of yourself, it has a dual effect. That is, by forgetting about yourself and your misery to help somebody else, it helps them and it helps you. And Robert?
Actually, that's perfect, because I was going to make a suggestion for Julie?
Yeah.
And anyone else who feels like they're not connected. Have you tried offering to volunteer at some organization?
No.
Because there's so many organizations in this town that could use your help, and they would appreciate it, and it gives you a chance to connect to other people.
That's a great suggestion. That's probably the most important suggestion when people say that they're lonely and they call a therapist and say, what do I do about this? There are so many opportunities to be with other people of like mind doing service. And that connects you to people very much like yourself, and people who do service seem to get, you know, you've heard about that. The service you do for others, you also do for yourself. So it was another person.
Okay, I'm going to bring this over.
Hi. So my question is, when the other person has a need, they're expressing it. It comes from pathology of some kind, like they want you to be a certain way, they want to control you, or, you know, they don't, you feel a certain way, but they want you to feel different. How do you feel?
So, the need is always legitimate. You cannot, you're an alive creature, you have needs, you're always going to be expressing your needs. There's never a need that isn't true. But, their belief about what's going on might be untrue. So you say, I hear you, I hear that you are feel threatened, or I hear that you feel abandoned, or I hear that. So they get affirmed right away at the base that they're coming from a good place. But I have to tell you that the way you're seeing the situation, I don't think is accurate, and your need won't get met that way. Let's work on why don't you try seeing the situation through my eyes? Because maybe it will turn out to be better for you. So you affirm you always affirm the person and where they're coming from. And then you say, let's look at whether your strategy is healthy or not. And I think you do that for countries too, just the same way.
Would you agree that ultimately each of us is responsible for meeting our own needs?
Absolutely. What she said is, would you agree that each of us is ultimately responsible for meeting our own needs? Yeah, that's... yes. No, you can't expect any other creature to meet your needs. You have to take responsibility for knowing what your needs are and for getting them met. However, you can ask for help. But it is primarily your responsibility. The way I usually say it is, look, if you're a conscious person, you have two jobs on the earth. You have to take care of yourself and you have to take care of other people. And if you only take care of other people and sacrifice yourself, at some point you're probably going to get resentful and start doing things that aren't good for other people. So if obliterating yourself for the good of others, in the moment it can happen. But in the long term, it's not a healthy strategy. Only taking care of other people, not yourself, is it won't work in the long term. And only taking care of yourself and not other people won't work real quickly. Because people are going to say, hey. So it's a dual charge. You really have to take care of yourself, and you have to take care of those that you're connected to. Okay,
perfect. I need the mic. I yell. What I don't understand is, for example, what we did, I'm trying to find a good example, what we did to the American Indians. Now, they would like to say, we'd like our land back. And we're sort of, how do we say, we listen to their arguments, say, we understand that, we gave you a reservation. And what, you know, do we take a oil from it, we feel like it? I mean, I don't know. How do you deal with that? Something like
that? You sit down and talk about it and try to come from what people really need and make the best possible solution.
But they need their land back.
I don't think that's necessarily true at this point. I think what they need is their integrity back and their dignity back and their power in the world back, and that may look differently these days than it used to. Anyway, this is just reiteration of what we did last week. I just wanted to kind of underline some of these ideas for you, because at every moment you're checking, at many moments you're checking in with yourself and you're finding that you're either okay or not okay. And you have to ask yourself, what am I feeling? And what need is underneath this? What need is met or unmet is creating this feeling? Because it's always the need that is creating the feeling, either a satisfied need or an unsatisfied need. And when you know what the need is, then you ask yourself, how do I go about getting that need met? And then your emotion changes. Otherwise, you just walk around in the same emotional state for the rest of your life. So what I just told you is the essence of therapy, self-therapy, which many of you already know.
It really helps me to be filled with compassion, to realize that all of our motivations really are based on us trying to get our needs met. The hardest times for me are like when, say, there's a mass shooting and somebody shoots up a school. They are really trying to get basic needs met that are very good, but it's the strategy that is all wrong. And they are, it's another belief that I have that really helps me, that they're doing the best they can at that moment based on what's going on in their internal family, their mind. And they can change, but they have to be able to work on that and change that. So it doesn't make it okay, but it helps me to forgive, to have compassion.
Yeah, so when the Rama, so that's why he like a criminal, he said you as lovingly as possible put him in jail. You know, because you don't keep it that way. So you can't help, no creature can help but be trying to stay alive, and that means having needs that need to get met. But their strategies can be so egregious that you have to, you know, remove them from doing harm to other people. Or you have to remove yourself from having harm done to you. Okay, so I'm going to change the focus now because I want to show you a video. So I got to introduce this really quickly. All right, so this is a video that is not generally available, and it doesn't have closed captioning, unfortunately, but happily, he speaks very clearly. So this video was made at the 6th World Congress of Positive Psychology, which took place a few months ago in Melbourne, Australia. And this is an NYU professor named John Haidt, H-A-I-E-T, who is remarkable. I showed you one video of his in this class a couple of years ago. So this is his new work. I'm only going to show you the first two-thirds of this video. He basically is talking about the youth and the problem that the youth are right now. And the second part of what he's going to say, I'm not going to show you for two reasons. First, because it's not time, and secondly, because it's very controversial right now. But what he's basically saying is the youth, we're overprotecting our kids. And by overprotecting our kids, we're leaving them unprepared for the real world. If you want to know more about that, he wrote a book called The Coddling of the Anglo-American Mind, which just came out, Coddling of the Anglo-American Mind. And he wrote an article for The Atlantic in 2015 about this subject. And it's a very controversial subject because it extends to the college campus. Who do you let speak at the college campus? Do you put trigger warnings on your syllabi? What do you say? You know, do you look at literature that might offend somebody? So there's all this stuff happening very currently at City College and other and throughout the country. So I'm not going to go there with this video. But the first part of the video is I am going to show you. And he's going to say toward the end of this video, this is the most important thing to happen to human beings since we learned to use fire.
What is
what I'm going to show you. Now, some of you have, we've talked about this a little bit before. Some of you we've talked about fairly extensively before. If you saw Jean Twenge when she was here at the Garden Theater, so this is going to be my ego moment for today. Back when nobody knew who Jean Twenge was a couple of years ago, or not that many people did, I read about her and I realized I gotta get her here to my supermarket. And we did, for too much money, but compared to what she costs now, nothing. Her work is pervading the cultural discourse at this point. So John Haidt is actually allied with her now, and much of what you're gonna see is her data. So if you were at Gene Twenge, you were there when the star was rising.
And I wrote it all up. It's on my column on EdHab News.
Okay, so actually, Robert wrote this, and you can see his review, beautiful review of her talk, on his column at EdHab News. If you want more, see Robert. Okay, so here we go.
room darkened to some extent.
It causes darkness, it's cold.
So, yeah, just do and watch your book. Would somebody...
We'll leave that one open. Okay, here we go.
Let's get the lights on.
I'll probably stop this a couple of times if the underlying stops, but I won't stop it too often. So here we go. And again, this is on the IPPA website, which you have to pay a lot of money to get on. So it's not generally available. Hopefully you can find it here. There it is. Okay, here we go. We start at 102.
All right. The disastrous consequences of ignoring basic insights from positive psychology. In his talk, Dr. Heisen discussed how ancient wisdom traditions offer valuable insights into how to live well and to get along with others, aligning with research in positive psychology.
I don't care about this.
Dr. Heisen argues generation, wisdom, and emotion.
Okay, here we go.
Morality, politics, and of course, happiness. So this is a real treat. Thank you, Dr. Heisen, for sharing your great work, really getting us to think and inspiring us all. With that, please help me in welcoming Dr. Jonathan Heisen.
Okay, well, good morning, everyone. People talk back from the audience. This is great. So it's a real pleasure to be here. I love IPA. I spoke here 4 years ago. I spoke here 4 years ago when I was in Florida. And this was my opening slide. I gave a talk on capitalism and flourishing and how if capitalism develops well, it leads to mass flourishing. And I began by talking about one of those first Akamal conferences, some of the conferences that, you know, Marty only holds meetings in beautiful places, and a bunch of us who were quite young then, Sonia's in the audience, still quite young. I talked about how we came up with this manifesto. We laid out what we thought positive psychology should be, and it was going to be the scientific study of optimal human functioning. And I also, in my talk 4 years ago, I also opened up with a metaphor that Marty used that sounds kind of like clunky and like not appropriate, but is actually really good. Marty once, just off the, you know, the top of his head, he just said, you know, our mission is we have to figure out how we can increase the total tonnage of happiness. And, you know, that seems like the wrong metaphor for happiness, right? I mean, you think about tonnage, you know, you think about, you know, an anchor, you think about a ship, a cargo ship. So it doesn't feel like the right metaphor for what we're doing. We're trying to increase the total number of shipping containers of happiness. But the more I thought about it, the more I worked with it, I actually think it is pretty good. And what I argued in my talk 4 years ago was that given that rising prosperity actually does bring more rights, more happiness, better living conditions, I actually argued that if we can help capitalism develop properly, it actually would be amazingly good. Increasing the total tonnage of shipping actually, in a way, increased the total tonnage of happiness. That was kind of a provocative idea that I, or trying to be provocative idea that I hope.
Okay, so can you hear?
Mm. Yes. Yes.
Good, because, okay. There's nothing I can do to make it better. Okay, here we go. Okay.
Put out there. It was a very optimistic talk. All the trends for global happiness were very, very positive. This talk is going to be different. This talk is much more pessimistic. A lot has changed in the last 4 years. In fact, I think that what the data is showing us, is a massive disappearance of human happiness, as though it's sinking into the sea, it's just disappearing. And the challenge, one of the biggest challenges, for positive psychology in the next 10 years, I believe, is can we help here? Can we help to address the mental health crisis in the young generation? And I think that we can. I think a couple of positive psychology ideas are absolutely crucial for reversing the enormous decrease in human happiness that has hit the young generation. Now, we've been talking about this a lot in the United States, about the rise of anxiety and depression. Now, we've been talking about the millennial generation for a long time. I want to ask you, people coming from multiple countries here, when you think about teenagers and college students today, is this the word you use, millennials? Raise your hand if this is the word for the okay, so it's a very commonly used term, but what I want to tell you is that you should stop using it for today's kids, because the kids who are in their teens and early 20s today are not millennials. We didn't know this 5 years ago, but now it's really clear. Kids born in 1996 and after are really different from the millennials. And marketers have been calling them Gen Z. That seems to be the name that has stuck. Gene Twenge wrote a book called iGen, like Internet Generation. But in the last 6 months, it's really clear, at least in the United States, Gen Z, and in other countries, Gen Z, is the winning term. So that's what it's going to be, Gen Z, or Gen Z. Let's talk about that. Now, the marketers are all doing these reports about Gen Z's brand preferences, and they try to give these optimistic stories about how Gen Z is really tolerant and really focused on, they're conscientious, and they try to tell a very positive story about Gen Z, and I think it's incorrect. I think that if you look at the data on Gen Z, it's more of a disaster epic, and we have to figure out why and what to do about it. So let me tell you that story, and then we'll bring in the positive psychology. So I'll show you data from the United States, but it's the same in Canada, the UK, and Australia. I don't know about continental Europe, but at least in the English language literature that I've been looking at, I'll show you the same pattern. So at least in the United States, when we look at how teenagers spend their time, what we see is that the percentage of 12th graders who have a driver's license, so these are 18-year-olds, the percentage of 18-year-old Americans who have a driver's license has been dropping fairly rapidly, beginning with late millennials and now into Gen Z. The percent that have tried alcohol ever has been dropping. The percent that have ever had anything that they would call a date has been dropping. Now, if you were like me, you know, in the 70s or 80s, part of the reason to get a driver's license was that so you could drink and go on a date. But now, you know, and it's good that they're not doing that, but actually the reason they're not doing it is, I think, not a good reason. Let's get into that. Also, the percent that have ever had a job, that have ever worked for pay, is also plummeting. Now, many of you work on college campuses, as I do. When an 18 or 19-year-old student comes to campus, we kind of expect that they've had certain experiences and that they're ready to live away from home. And these are the kinds of experiences that we expect students to have, and now increasingly don't have them. Their first time being away from their parents might be when they arrive in college, and they just don't have the life experience. Now, each generation teases the one behind it. Each generation thinks the one behind it is soft. That's been going on for thousands of years. This is different. This is hard data on how the current young generation is doing terribly. So this is nationally representative data on their disabilities. As you see, learning disability is not really a physical disability.
What he's saying here is this is unprecedented. You know, every generation thinks the generation behind them is not doing well. Rock and roll is going to make you all crazy. And we, as young kids, wrote, the kids are all right, and leave us kids alone. And, you know, they're not writing those songs now. Okay. There really is something happening.
So in 2010, all the college students were millennials. In 2016, they're all Gen Z. So as Gen Z replaces the millennials, physical disability and ADHD do go up a little bit. But what's that yellow line? Psychological disorders goes way, way up. As soon as Gen Z comes to campus, psychological disorders skyrocket. But it's not all psychological disorders. It's only anxiety and depression. That's it. Nothing else. Anxiety and depression. And it's mostly the girls. So the universal patterns of the boys are up, the girls are way up. So this is a major depression based on answering 5 out of 9 questions on a sim.
So I just want to show you that graph a little bit better. For boys in the last year, a major depressive episode, which means you know, you're unfunctional. For boys, it's about 7%. For girls, it's 20%, 1 out of 5. I said a major depressive episode in the last year. I work at City College, and always in my classes, I have several students who tell me at the beginning of class that I'm probably going to have to miss a lot of class because I'm just going to not be functional part of the time. And they get special dispensation. There are ways at City College that we handle that in a compassionate way. But it always happens. It's always true that there's a significant number of students that are not going to be able to just be students.
And they're mainly girls for you? Girls?
It's been mainly girls for me, but not entirely. But yeah, mainly female.
Okay. Now checklists. So when the millennials were in college, the numbers were stable. I'm sorry, this is all teenagers, not college. The numbers were stable, but as Gen Z enters the data set, as you see, the boys go up, the girls go way up. Now there's been some skepticism. This is a psychiatrist who writes the New York Times, who has been arguing that this is just an artifact of self-report, that there's not any real crisis, that Gen Z is so comfortable talking about depression, well, this is a good thing. We shouldn't worry, and it certainly is not caused by smartphones. Don't worry, that's a moral panic. Don't worry about that, he says. I believe he is wrong, and I'll show you why I think that. Because if we look at behavioral data, we see it too. Not in this slide, because this is boys. This is hospital admissions for non-fatal self-injuries. These are kids who deliberately cut themselves mostly or otherwise harm themselves, had to be hospitalized. How many out of 100,000 American teenagers were admitted to hospital? And what you see in this study is that for boys, there's no trend. As we go from 2001 to 2015, the numbers are flat. But now look at the data for girls. So you'll see the means are higher. So the means are much higher. Boys, clinical psychologists say that girls have more internalizing disorders. They make themselves miserable. Boys have more externalizing disorders. They make other people miserable with alcoholism and vandalism and delinquency. But self-harm is mostly a teenage girl thing, is a manifestation of anxiety. And what you see is that there's no trend up until 2009. But look what happens after 2009. The older teen girls, their rate of hospital admission is up 62%. This is not self-report. This is not Gen Z is so comfortable going to hospitals. This is actual self-injury. The youngest girls, the preteens, they didn't used to cut themselves, but now they do. Their rate is up 189%. It's nearly tripled just in the last 7 or so years. Now, interestingly, this is very important for the story that I'm trying to tell. The oldest bracket in this study, age 20 to 24, these are not Gen Z. In this study, that age bracket makes them millennials. The millennials did not get social media until they got to college. That's the dividing line. So young millennial women got social media in college. Their brains were already developed. They don't now suddenly start cutting themselves. It's only the girls who got it when they were young, too young, I believe, to be on social media. It's not just self-harm, it's actual completed suicides. So we now have the highest rate that ever recorded for suicide for teenage girls. And again, with this pattern, the increases are largest for the youngest girls. So this is 10 to 14-year-old boys in blue on the top and girls in orange. And what you see is that the rate for girls has been relatively steady, but all of a sudden, beginning in 2013, it more or less doubles, nearly doubles, and it keeps going up from there. So teenage girls, preteen girls, are now closing the gap with preteen boys on completed suicides. When Gen Z arrived on college campuses in 2014, that's when we started hearing all these reports across the country that student health services were flooded, that they couldn't handle the demand. And it just has been going up every year since then. if you talk to anyone in higher education, anyone who runs a university, they all say the same thing. They all say, we are overwhelmed. We cannot keep up with the demand. This is data on major depression or severe depression for college students. Once again, when the millennials were the college students, there was no trend. There was no change. As soon as Gen Z arrives on campus, the numbers shoot up. Boys are up, girls are way up. This is the universal pattern.
Well, someone, I want to show you that.
Data from counseling, anyone in higher education, anyone who runs a university,
I want to show you that graph.
They all say the same thing. They all say, we are overwhelmed. We cannot keep up with the demand. This is...
Okay, so severe depression rate of U.S. college students. In 2017, the percentage of U.S. college students who had experienced severe depression, it doesn't say what time frame this is, I assume that this is in the past year, is like 40%. 40%. And for males, up over 20%. Okay. Used to be, for males, 10%, for females, like 17%. So 17% to 38% is more than double. And that's 4 out of every 10. When I give my lectures on anxiety and depression, no matter what else they were doing with their phones before I was talking about anxiety and depression, suddenly every kid is paying attention. And when I talk about the effect of antidepressant medication and anti-anxiety medication, never seen so many hands go up. Data on major depression or severe depression for college students. Once again, when the millennials were the college students, there was no trend, there was no change. As soon as Gen Z arrives on campus, the numbers shoot up. Boys are up, girls are way up. This is the universal pattern. Data from counseling centers. When students check into student health for any sort of psychological issue, what are they checking in for? And what you see here is that nothing is rising. Nothing is rising except for anxiety and depression. So if Dr. Friedman was right, that Gen Z is just so open and comfortable, then everything should be rising, but it's not. Note that stress is not rising. Gen Z is not more stressed than previous generations. They just never learned how to handle the ordinary stresses of daily life. We never gave them the chance. So I've been showing you American data, but I've recently been collecting international data. So if you go to thecoddling.com and then about the book, International Coddling, I have open source Google documents. I welcome your contributions, especially if you're from these countries. And we find the same thing in Britain. Surveys show clearly that happiness for girls is going down. Self-harm, this is British data. Self-harm is up a little bit for boys and up a lot for girls. And again, at the same time, right around 2012, 2013 is when things go through the roof. Same thing in Canada. The curve is not as sharp here, but once again, we see the rate for boys. This is the percent who chose the bottom two categories for self-reports of mental health. So poor mental health, fair poor mental health, is increasing for boys, and it's increasing more rapidly for girls. Self-harm, same story. It's up slightly, this is Canadian data. It's up slightly for the boys. It's way up for the girls. Australian data, I don't have self-harm data, but serious mental illness, same pattern, not as sharp, but again, up for the boys, up a lot more for the girls. So why? Why is this happening? Why is it happening at the same time in multiple countries? Why does it always affect the girls a lot more than the boys? And why do we get gigantic percentage increases for the 10 to 14-year-old girls, much bigger than the older girls? Why? I think, you know, this is very hard to know. This is all so new, but here's my best explanation. Again, this comes from my book with Greg Lugiano, The Cognitive the American Mind. So this is data on when teens, American teens, migrated onto social media. So here's the story. In 2006, Facebook opens up to the world before they had to be a college student. And so it opens up to the world, but very few 12-year-old kids have Facebook. In 2007, the iPhone comes out, and so now you can have Facebook and other social media in your pocket with you at all times, but it's very expensive, and very few 12-year-olds have an iPhone. In 2009, Facebook adds the like button, which is extremely important for our story, because the like button allows every teenager to
to have like a little button. If you've seen the famous video of B.F. Skinner conditioning a pigeon, you know, if you can give a little tiny reinforcement to the pigeon for turning a little bit, you can train it to turn the circle in, you know, a few minutes, an hour. It doesn't take long. Well, in 2009, all of a sudden, all American teams were given a butt to train all other American teams, and boy, did they train each other. Little tiny reinforcements for the right behavior and punishments for the wrong behavior by ignoring them or, of course, nasty comments as well. But the like button makes Facebook much more addictive, and all the other social media companies, many of them copy. So social media becomes much more addictive, much more harmful in 2009, and lo and behold, that is when American teams migrate on. So this is the percentage that use it on a daily basis, and in 2009, it was most teams were not, or half or less were using it every day. But in 2011, you see the steep curves there. That's the two-year period where life for American teenagers stops being about going over to a friend's house. And it becomes, you go home, you sit on your bed, and you spend the whole afternoon, if you're not scheduled for an activity, you spend all your free time connecting through social media. And so social media explains the timing perfectly. It's exactly what you would predict if you thought social media was the cause of the mental health crisis. Social media also perfectly explains the sex difference, because girls use social media a lot more than boys. When boys all got iPhones, what did they do? Video games and later porn. But for girls, it's social media. Girls are much more affected by constant social comparison. We've known this because of eating disorder research. Girls are much more affected by constant social comparison data. And it was bad enough, you know, when I was a kid, there was a lot of talk about how these airbrushed models, these fake, unrealistic ideas of feminine beauty are distorting teenage girls' body images. So we were talking about that in the 80s. Well, what is it like to be a teenage girl now when it's not models? It's your own friends. If everyone's on Instagram and you take a selfie, my niece showed me this. She presses a button, her face gets narrower, her eyes get bigger, and her skin gets perfectly smooth. So all your friends are more beautiful than you are now.
Understand what they're seeing on when they do this social media stuff. They're not seeing the real world. They're seeing their friends enhanced. They're seeing the best moments of their friends. So in comparison to what they're being seen, they suck. Their life is, they're less this, and he just showed you that there are these things that automatically adjust you to be more beautiful before your picture goes out. And you don't share pictures of nothing. You share pictures of, here's what I did that was great, right? So everybody thinks everybody else is doing great, except them.
That's very hard. Finally, also the fear of missing out, fear of being left out, this is much more important for girls than boys, it looks important for both. And finally, girls and boys are equally aggressive. Teenagers are often very aggressive. Boys' aggression has always been physical, the threat of violence. And so when they're all on video games, they're not being physically violent. It's all virtual, and it's a game, and it's teamwork. My son joins his friends, and they roam around vast, beautiful, imaginary worlds, killing other groups of boys. It's actually perfectly healthy. But it's not as bad as we thought. The data is complicated, but it's not. The video games are not as violent. Video games are not as bad as was thought, but it's still debated. But what do girls do? Girls' aggression has always been relational. Girls damage each other's relationships. That's the form that female aggression. Nikki Crick's research in the 70s, 80s, and 90s showed this. And so social media amplifies this by 10. It allows them to do it constantly and anonymously. So for all these reasons, social media is bad for everyone. I shouldn't say bad for everyone. It's bad on average for boys. Some kids benefit. But on average, if you look at the mental health data, so this is British data, a really good study with good measurement. So the more you use social media, so for boys, if you use it not at all or 2 hours a day, there's no change. But heavy users have much higher rates of depression. For girls, as you see, the curve is much sharper. So girls who use social media a lot have much worse mental health than girls who don't. Now, this is all correlational, but there are a lot of correlational studies that find the same pattern. What about experiments? I found five true experiments. They all find an effect. So this is one done at Penn. Undergrads were randomly assigned to either limit Facebook, Instagram, and Snapchat, or to use it as normal. And what they found is that for those who had a high score on the BDI, that is those who had some pre-existing depression, bad mood, when they limited social media, those scores dropped. They got happier. So there's direct experimental evidence that moving off social media, and, you know, you've all heard people say this, you know, oh, I gave up social media for a month, I feel so much better. So there is experimental evidence that that works. I found four other true experiments, and worked with Gene Twenge on this. Four others, they all show an effect. We found none that don't show an effect. We're collecting all of this. If you're interested in digging in more, you can go to the coddling.com, solutions to mental health. We have, again, open source Google documents. If you're a researcher, please, I'll give you permission. You can add your comments, add links. If you've done studies, please put them in. So this is my report to you on what I think is really a catastrophe. If we care about the total happiness, if we care about kids, if we care about girls, what's happening, we didn't know this 5 years ago, but now it's really clear. What's happening, I think, is a catastrophe. I should be careful about catastrophizing, but I think the data kind of shows it. Like, it is not a small increase, it's a very large increase. And I told you that I think social media is a major part of the cause. Now let's link this to positive psychology. So many of us had the great privilege and honor to work with Chris Peterson. We're all very fond of him and his victim. Other people matter. Well, what does social media do to relationships? I'm working with a really wonderful anthropologist who started a consulting firm. So he's doing all this brand research on Gen Z, and he's been doing brand research on teenagers since 2008, so he has data going back that far. And he came to me because he said, I hear you're studying the effects of social media on kids. I've got all this qualitative data, I've been doing all this research, and I'm seeing these effects. And so he shared with me the report on family life, what's happening for American family life. And what they're seeing is that in recent years, leisure activities are more individualized, families are alone together, shared family rituals are declining, more of the day is devoted to personal devices. I cannot believe these numbers. Tweens, that is ages 8 to 12, you know, between childhood and teens, they spend 6 hours a day using technology, mostly their own private technology. 6 hours a day. And older teens, 12 to 18, spend 9 hours a day. I didn't remember that many hours in the day, you know? Once you have sleep and, well, you can take away some sleep. So 9 hours a day doing things that, in a sense, they connect you to others, but not to the people near you.
So that's how much, that's probably the most authoritative data on how much time kids are looking at their phones or other screens, but mostly their phones, 9 hours a day. That's more than they seek. That's more than any other single activity. And I've heard that over and over again. And when I ask the kids about this, I say, sure. That's what they, the minute that they, a break comes, in class, the phones come out. And even when they're in class, they're sneaking their phone, and I constantly have to stop the class. They remember we have a rule about this, but then they walk out, and they walk out like this, and you have to avoid them, or you get run over. You know? And they just spend, you know, and they're in their cars all the time like this, you know. So they just, that's what they do. Because, you know this, the reason why it's so addictive is because the reward pathway in the middle of your brain, the dopamine pathway, whenever you anticipate something good, that pathway fires and it motivates you to go toward it. So it's not only when you experience something good, it's when you anticipate it. So even if the last 25 things that you got from social media weren't very cool or weren't very relevant to you, there might be something, so you check it. And if it isn't there, then you check it again, because it's like playing the slot machine. You know, you keep pulling because eventually you're going to win, you know, or somebody's going to win. That keeps you playing forever. And so these kids are literally addicted. It's the same mechanism for any other addiction. And it's after a while, it becomes, it could be the next time. It could be the next thing. It could be the next thing that if you miss it. It's called FOMO, right? If you're missing out. If you miss it, you missed it. You know, so you can't miss it. So that's why kids get up in the middle of the night and check their phones. Okay, anyway, let's go back.
So a quote from this report, now that we're always on our devices, I feel like we never hang out. Here's an email I got as I've been writing about this from a Canadian college student. I am one of the many Gen Z students you speak about suffering from depression and anxiety, a battle which eventually led to self-harm and hospitalization. Oxymoronically, Gen Z are an incredibly isolated group of people. We have shallow friendships and superfluous romantic relationships mediated and governed by social media. And then he says, there's hardly a sense of community on campus, and it's not hard to see. Oftentimes, I'll arrive early to a lecture to find a room of 30-plus students sitting together in complete silence, often absorbed in their smartphones, afraid to speak and be heard by their peers. This leads to further isolation and a weakening of self-identity and confidence.
I told you this before. I wish I could take you all to any of my classes. You would see, I guarantee what you would see. If it's especially if it's a night class, it's really dramatic. Because when you walk into a night class, I have 40 people typically in a class. What happens is you walk into the class, no one has turned the light on. The only light is the light of all the phones. There is not a sound. Everybody is in their phone. They do not know who the person next to them is. When I put them in small groups to discuss the exercise for the week, they're terrified to talk to one another. They can't, some people, they actually can't. I say you can't, you gotta get in the group, but you don't have to talk. Because they can't actually verbalize one another. But it used to be 10 years ago, when I walked into a classroom, it took me 5 minutes to shut them up. Because they're all flirting with one another. And now it's absolute dead silence. It was so bad that in my class that I just started, my Psych 100 class, my introductory psych class, I walked in and it was the same, it wasn't dark yet, but there was no sound and every person was like this, every single person. I walked in and I exploded. That was their first experience of me. I said, stop, okay, I gotta talk to you right now. Look what's happening here. And I just laid it out for them. Rich.
It's like that on a New York subway too.
Yeah, instead of like chatting, well, New York, it's always been a little young pop, your neighbor.
You don't know who that is.
What's your first name?
Alan. But you know, it's not just kids, it's adults, it's old people. I'm in a hospital, I go to a doctor's office, and there's people that are my age, and they're all doing the same thing, you know.
Yeah. And it used to be breakfast is when people talk to one another. Now it's everybody checking their phone at breakfast. Adults, everybody. You know. But the kids, it's accentuated. Okay, anyway, let's go back a little more because I want to end on a positive note if possible. And we're not there yet. All right, so here you go.
So what would Chris say if he was here to witness what's happening? What would Chris say about what's happening to Gen Z? I think he would say that other people matter. But in the age of social media, the people who should matter most to us get far less of our time and attention. We're always busy with strangers often, or with people we barely know. While people whom we will never meet get far more of our attention and have far more power over our emotional lives. This is not a recipe for mass flourishing, for mass happiness. Incidentally, I got this picture from a beautiful essay by Senga Mainham and Catherine Britton called You Matter, Chris. And he certainly does and did. So to close up this part of the talk, raise your hand if you have kids under the age of 21. Raise your hand, probably about half of you. This is not the full story, but if you want someplace to start, because everybody's looking for advice, what do I do? These are three rules that I think are very defendable, not radical. One, all screens out of the bedroom by a set time. There's no reason to leave an addicting device, a slot machine, under your kid's pillow. To interrupt their sleep. No screens in the bedroom after a certain time. Second, no social media until at least high school. That's the battle I'm fighting now. We've got to get it out of middle schools. The United States middle school is about ages 11 to 13. There's no reason that such kids should be on social media at all. And it's hard for any one kid to get off, but if we can set the norm and make it clear, this is incredibly bad for you. If we can get principals to start making statements, I'm trying to get the American Academy of Pediatrics to make a statement so we can change norms. Just get out of middle school for starters, although I think 16 or 18 will end up being the age at which it's okay. And third, there's no hard and fast rule on screen time. It turns out screen time itself is not so bad. It's specifically social media. But if you have no budget, if you don't have a limit, you've got thousands of psychologists in Silicon Valley who make their money by keeping your kid on much longer than you or your kid want to be on. So you have to have limits and agree to them with your kid, and then that will help everybody. Finally, I think advice to us in positive psychology is this is like the biggest thing since the invention of fire, practically. This is transforming human life. And we need to be studying this intensively. I know there are sessions on it here, but we need to really all be aware of just how quickly social media is changing social life and mental health. All right, so that's the biggest single piece, I think, is...
Okay, so that's the part of the talk I wanted to show you. Let me see where we are for time. Okay, so because we're out of time, I guess I will send you out. With that, there is a wonderful affirmative thing that I will show you sometime next week that kind of balances this off. So I guess you're going to have to write your own shift here. But let's see, let's have a comment or two. Bob?
Is this cross-cultural? You know, spending time about what's going on in Europe or Asia, maybe it isn't so bad.
Oh, actually, it's worse in Asia. It's worse in Asia. It's actually been the governments of Asian countries have actually been monitoring this more assiduously because the kids are more on their phones more. I don't know about it in some other places, but in places where people can afford smartphones, it seems to be ubiquitous.
It's terrible in Japan. I just came back from Japan, and the teenagers are all...
Oh, yeah, in Japan, it's like... They're just like
they're committing suicide.
Yeah, suicide is way up. It's true. Okay, so let's see. We'll go around. Okay, so a couple of comments. So, Reed, first we'll go this way. And
this morning in the New York Times, there was a brief article about Facebook eliminating the count of the like buttons. That they're discussing that. You will see on your own how many likes and hearts you have. But the other people who are liking you or giving hearts will not see that count or the names of the people. So they're doing an experiment on that.
In Australia.
Australia. Yeah, it's in Australia. Okay.
And this is because they're afraid of getting broken up, you know, basically. That they're under scrutiny. Otherwise, they wouldn't be taking this pro-social step. Okay.
This on YouTube.
Again?
Can I get this on
YouTube? No, you can't get this at all. However, there's tons. First of all, go to the Kotlin.com, maybe.
Well, it's all in my article. This is all the stuff that Twenge talked about.
I'm just telling you
this specific talk you can't get. You can't get this specific talk because it's locked up in this IPPA.
Yeah, but this is all in Twenge's article.
Was it some
short? Yeah, she would need the slides and stuff too. But you can go to the Kotlin.com. Okay, so Morty's next, and we know Iris, and we know the...
What about that segment of the population of conscious young people who reject the world on the basis of what they're presented with, Trump, etc. And because of that, that anxiety leads them to search for ways to get out of it in a mass way. So the bone gives them that introduction to others.
Absolutely. Something I read to you a couple of years ago in this class, I quoted some teenager saying, I usually have several windows on the world open, and real life usually isn't my favorite one.
Treatment, just a completely different size, but the actual treatment, pharmaceutical treatment that we have right now for depression actually causes one of the effects of suicide.
There is some problem with some of the medications actually in young kids making more suicidality.
It's so prevalent,
we've
actually added a black box around it.
Ah. Let's see, with two more people. Iris and then three more people.
My daughter works at EF International, an English teacher. And she said the children come in, and she said has a provocative study to do, and nobody wants to talk. And she makes them all put their cell phones, you know, into a basket. And and she'll have a wonderful topic on how do you like Santa Barbara, what do you like about it? Nobody says a word. And they're waiting for their mother to call them from that foreign country. They're on with their parents all day long.
Oh yeah, that's another part of this we didn't talk about. But the point is, the reason that the kids are unprepared for the world is because every decision is made
It used to be helicopter parents, now it's smartphone parents. And anything comes up, what do I do? I mean, how many calls go back and forth between the average teen, the average college girl and her mother per day? Oh my God. You know, what do I do with this? What should I wear now? Okay, cool.
My medication doesn't help me when I take for anxiety and my depression and jitteriness, it doesn't help me.
So do you go on your phone? Because people escape the world, the real world, by going on their phone, you know, and that's their antidepressant. Okay, so I need an
Is there any data on social media usage according to socioeconomic status?
I bet there is, I don't know it. But just Google social media usage and socioeconomic status, and up will come what you want. Okay, so let's break for, now, when you walk out of here, probably most of you, or some of you, are not going to pull out your phones. We were at City College, and I can film you, every single kid, they're really good. It's like drawing a gun, you know? They're like this, you know? That fast, man. The minute they get out of that door, they're on the phone.
All right,
I'll see you next week.
Thank you. So, being my first, you know, Wednesday and Friday, these are my first ever classes at City College. If you just repeat everything, if you teach us again next spring.
I never.